everyone, and welcome to another heartbreaking episode of Setting the Tone, an ER retrospective, the show where we do a chronological breakdown of every episode of our favorite TV medical drama. I want to cry, and my name is Elizabeth, and thank you. And joining me today, as always, is Lauren.
I guess I'm here.
And Daniel?
Hey.
Yep.
It's that kind of episode, people, because today we're going to be discussing Season 10, Episode 21, which is titled Midnight. The episode aired on May 6, 2004. Lauren, what was going on that week 20 years ago?
I don't want to do this. Pat Tillman, a U.S. Army Ranger and former safety for the Arizona Cardinals in the NFL, is killed in action in Afghanistan after sustaining 3 bullet wounds to the head. The official statement regarding his death is that he was killed in a roadside ambush by Afghani insurgents. However, it was later reported by the Washington Post that his death was the result of friendly fire, and that he'd expressed anti-war sentiments to his fellow soldiers in the days leading up to his death, including calling the war in Iraq fucking illegal. This report was later verified after Congress and the Department of Defense conducted their own investigations.
And the NFL will not shut up about him, even 20 years later.
Okay.
It's true. They do. They trot him out for everything. They trot out his, you know, memory or whatever, you know.
His legacy or whatever.
Yeah. And his family hates it.
And a complete 180, Mean Girls, the teen comedy starring Lindsay Lohan, Rachel McAdams, Lacey Chabert, Chabert, and Amanda, I give up, guys, and Amanda Seyfried, and written by Tina Fey, debuts and takes the top spot at the box office, and guys, she doesn't even go here. By Usher featuring Ludacris and Lil Jon is still the number one song. Daniel, what else was on?
Daniel.
Ooh, I give up. We got a big one tonight, fam. What else was on at?
Yeah, didn't include this in the headlines because I figured Daniel will cover it.
At 8 p.m., we have a 2-part Friends retrospective, the one with all the other ones, a Friends retrospective, which, man, if I hated myself just a little bit more, that would have been a great podcast title for a project that I am not going to do. And then at 9, leading up to the 2-part final episode of Friends, the series finale, the last one, parts 1 and 2. This takes up the whole 9 o'clock hour, and they have a whopping 52.4 million people tuning in to watch the very last episode of Friends. It is very strange to think about that, like, if you'll recall, like, Friends and ER start 7 days apart from one another. Like, those are two shows that are indelibly linked and have been part of each other's histories up to this point. And after this week, we will not be saying anything about Friends in the 8 o'clock time slot. I mean, I'm sure we'll get a rerun here and there, but, like, that show has now ended, and we still have a full 5 seasons to go on ER. So that's pretty wild to think about. And just, like, I mean, I guess there have been certain things in pop culture, in, like, the monoculture that have endured into the 2000s, you know, like, thinking about, like, Game of Thrones, I guess, the last episode of that, or, like, you know, the last episode of The Sopranos is a few years after this. Like, there were certain things that lots and lots of people were invested
in. Big event TV.
And tuned into. But, like, I don't know that we've ever had anything get to this level again, like, after the end of Friends. Like, this is the last big, like, TV finale where it's, like, they're playing this on the big screen in Times Square like they did for the Seinfeld finale. Like, this is a major event type of thing, and it's just crazy to think about, like, that we've basically borne witness to the entire run of Friends by covering this show that happened to come on an hour after it.
Just think we'd be done by now if we had done Friends.
See, you fucked up there. You bet on the wrong horse, Lauren. You'd be done already. But yeah, just pretty wild to think about. 52.4 million viewers tuning into one episode, well, 2 episodes of television, a 2-part episode. Just crazy to think about. I don't remember. I'm sure I watched the last episode of Friends because I know my parents were into it, but I couldn't tell you anything about it other than the broadest of strokes, you know, that, like, everybody ends with a mostly happy ending. Like there was no big, like, you know, shock twist thing at the end where it was all a dream or something like that. Like,
oh, I know we've got listeners who are going
to. Oh, yeah. I know we've got a lot of fans of the show, and they have a much better grasp on it. I think hearing stuff after Matthew Perry died, I feel like I remember people, or maybe it was old interviews with him that were dug up, but like he ends up with the last line of the series, I think. Mm. So yeah, just a huge, huge milestone thing here, like not just for the show Friends, but also ER and also just television in general and the monoculture in general. Like, I don't think you'll see anything like that ever again. But out of that 52.4 million viewers, roughly half kept their TVs on afterwards. So we are keeping with a solid 28.3 million, which is far and away the high water mark for viewership for the whole season. We have not seen a number that high in quite some time. 28.3 million viewers tuning in, directed by Julie Hebert, doing her third out of four, and previous one of hers from this season was Shifts Happen, and written by John Wells, doing his 27th out of 32, and previous ones of his from this season include Makemba, The Lost, and Now What?
Before we get into the actual episode, I just need to tell you, I just had the unhinged idea of, oh, I'm going to put all the viewership numbers into a sheet and do a graph on how our viewership goes over the 15 seasons when we're done.
No.
Will I?
No.
Probably, yeah. Because that's still easier than my day job.
No, you're not.
Okay. I got another 2 years before I have to even worry about
that's
it.
That's true. That's true. Who knows?
I might be better by then.
A girl can dream.
As I previously alluded to, got a sad one for year for you folks. So there's a big old content warning for a devastating loss of a child. So if that's something you might be sensitive to, we'll see you again next week for the season finale. Please take care of yourself, and we love you.
Much like Love's Labor Lost, I have repeatedly heard people over the years cite this episode as a triggering one, so I felt it was particularly important that we note that at the top. Like, there's people who this episode is not just not a fun watch, it's a can't watch. So
yeah
well, definitely was not a fun watch for us this week, let me tell you. All right, previously on is brought to us by Carter, and oh boy, here we go. Cam and Carter are opening some baby shower presents, so let's listen into their happy conversation.
What else do we get?
Another book from Elizabeth Corday. Elizabeth, who's that?
Surgeon, British.
The American way of birth.
Oh, don't let Dr. Ford catch you reading that.
Oh, yeah? Why not?
Because it argues that the shift from home births and midwives to hospital births and C-sections is the result of American OB's greed. All right, what do you think?
I'll read it today.
No, about the paint.
Maybe something with more blue? Maybe? You know, Americans are way too neurotic and technology reliant. I mean, with all your money and equipment, your infant mortality rate is still terrible.
Oh, you'd rather be back in Kivu, giving birth on a concrete floor?
No, you're like 34th or something, behind Guam.
I like the second one.
Too much gray.
Well, why don't we ask George?
Oh, George.
You don't like George?
Oh, please.
I like George. It's the name of the first president of the United States. The Quiet Beetle.
The current occupant of the White House.
Well, no name is perfect. Hey, George, it's Dad. Say, listen, would you rather be born on the filthy dirt floor of a primitive mud hut in Central Africa?
Or
in a modern hospital surrounded by the finest doctors and equipment in the world? Kick once for America, twice for the mud hut.
I resent your characterization.
He's deciding.
He's not deciding.
He's deciding.
You know what? He's sleeping.
No.
Oh, God. Y'all can't see my face because I'm recording in a pitch black room right now, but ugh, just the grimace.
I mean, they can't see your face anyway. This is an audio.
No, I was saying podcast. Y'all. Sorry, y'all as in you two can't see my face. But it works because the listeners can't either, but thank you for ruining the illusion.
Shut up.
I
do what I want.
Unlike Love's Labor Lost, which is the world's worst double feature to pair with this. Unlike Love's Labor Lost, where that is the episode where everything's going fine until it's not, this episode is the kind of the yin to that yang, where it's like everything's fine for about the first 30 seconds of this episode before they start dropping hints that there's a big problem. And I was shocked watching this again, because I probably haven't watched this episode in, well, that's, I take that back, I haven't watched this episode since Jake and I did the fucking flash forward.
Whoopsie doodle.
Poor Jake decided to pick that,
never watch season 10,
pick that one out of a hat. But yeah, like, I haven't watched this episode since then, and I haven't really watched it, you know, for, you know, a serious absorption of it since I watched it originally, you know, way back when. So, like, I was really taken aback by how little ambiguity and how little, like, they don't toy with you for the most part in this episode.
No.
There's no, like, will they, won't they, is this a problem, is this, like, they don't, which I kind of appreciate to a certain degree, mm-hmm. because it's like, okay, if you're gonna fucking shit in my soul, just drop Trow and shit in my soul. Like, I need you to just get it over with. I don't need you to stand over me and, like, be like, oh, I might do it, I might shit in your head. Like, just get it over with. And that's something that I have to give credit to this episode for. Is it incredibly sad? 100%. But at least it doesn't string you along. At least it doesn't make you go, oh, well, maybe there's a chance they'll get through this. No,
that's
they
fair.
Make it pretty clear from the get-go that, like, this is bad and it's only going to get worse. So, you know, kudos for that. And also, I always appreciate a good W dunk in any in any sound clip.
Yep.
I always appreciate shitting on W while we're here. Like, just
I mean, this is one of only two audio clips today, because, like, the rest of the storyline is, like, it's fantastic acting, but it's also heavily dependent on Kem's face.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean,
and is way more impactful with
Let's just get that out of the way right now. These two, as I'm saying it right now, these two are 1 and 1A co-MVPs of this episode, of, like, knocking it out of the park. Some of the finest dramatic work we've ever seen out of Noah Wiley, maybe we'll ever see. And Kem's performance, Tandy Way Newton's performance, is so haunting, I think is the word. Like, it is just so, and I feel like
it's visceral,
and I feel like that's a big part of why, for so many people, like I said at the top, this isn't just a tough watch, this is a can't watch, because it's such a, you know, visceral, you're feeling everything that she's feeling. And
is being viscerally stoic a thing? Because, like, that's kind of, like,
I think that's just catatonic. Like, I think that,
yeah, I guess so. Because, which basically she is for most of this episode.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's, whew, yeah.
As you would be in this
situation. As 100% you would be. Ugh. Just, ugh, awful.
And because this episode is just bad all around for people, we go over to Sam doing laundry when Steve comes back from dropping Alex off at school, and we learn he gave Alex a condom. Way to go, Father of the Year. And to continue being a winner, he starts to put the moves on Sam, and she's like, nope, absolutely not. Bye.
Can
Leave
I put
me
Steve
alone.
On the shitty kids list?
You sure can.
For this episode.
He can go on, because he acts like a child.
Were Alex not, you know, 10, I would say, like, okay, actually, this is a good father move.
Yeah,
you know,
if he's like 14 or 15 or something like
but
that,
he's
sure.
10.
If there was any reasonable expectation that he might be having sex, then sure. Like, I always think it's silly when parents get overly, you know, pearl clutchy about the idea that their underage children might be, you know, screwing around. And if they're gonna do it, at least, you know, make sure they're safe.
Be
about
safe.
It. But
yeah,
Alex is 10.
Don't be like Brian from, let me consult the list, episode 16, the Clap Boy.
That's the worst superhero name I've ever heard. Yeah, Alex is 10 and, like, seems more interested in torturing small animals than he does sex. So, like, I don't think that I don't think the condom thing is warranted at this point.
He wants to do surgery for the lols, not for the medical part of it.
Guys, I'm just going to say it because I'm never going to get to say this. It's very Joffrey Baratheon. Way more into murder than sex.
There you go.
just, I'm never going to get to make a Game of Thrones reference on this podcast. So with that being said, we go over to the ER and the med students are graduating tomorrow. Yay! 19 members of Neela's family are coming to the ceremony and Pratt is making fun of them for being new doctors and saying, enjoy it, your malpractice starts tomorrow.
I swear I don't want to get overly pedantic and I don't want to get into the weeds about it, but it was pointed out by several sources and you know, IMDb goof sections and things like that, that there has been an acceleration of Neela's timeline where at the beginning of the season, Neela says she's a third year medical student when med school is traditionally 4 years.
Mm-hmm.
So she wouldn't be graduating for another year. And Abby's is a little fuzzier. Abby is at least canonically up to this point, supposedly a year ahead of Neela, but then of course she takes a break and she's off, you know, so like Neela and Abby should be about a year apart in their training, but they're graduating together and neither one really might be right on schedule for graduation. So there's a little bit of fuzziness there.
Good to know. Then we are in with Bangs and we hear Sam and Luca are just going to hang out tonight because she misses him. Aww. Mm. There's an ambulance run comes in. There's a naked old guy found wandering the halls of his nursing home and he is very out of it. Very state of confusion and aggressive.
Yes, and we will later learn this gentleman's name is Mr. Ferguson. He's played by actor Martin Charles Warner, who appears in stuff like Mr. Woodcock, very apt for this episode, Armed and Dangerous, and Suddenly Susan.
Because we got to have some lightheartedness in this episode, folks.
Right, and if,
in the form of a guy suffering from dementia.
If flabby old man ass is what gets us there, I'll take it.
Flabby old man ass is the title of my sex tape. All right,
that's what I was gonna say. That's what I was gonna say.
I was gonna say nickname in high school.
That's what I was gonna say during the audio clip or coming out of the audio clip. It jumped out of my brain and I couldn't think of it. So thank you for bringing that thought back into my head. Primitive Mud Hut.
There you go.
Primitive Mud Hut was my nickname in high school.
All right, Frank is back. Yay! And he's doing the straight people thing of complaining about his wife because, fellas, isn't it gay to love your wife? Like, am I right?
Got to push those emotions down somehow.
Exactly. Go back to Kevin Carter and, oh no, Carter wants her to do kick counts. So fun.
It's like I said, they don't really waste any time getting to, because there's even in that first scene a little bit less, but definitely more so here, you can feel and the audience can feel the palpable and escalating alarm in Carter. Like even though it hasn't made it to Kim yet, you can see on Carter's face and just the way he's behaving, you can feel like, holy shit, like he's doing the internal thing of like, I don't want to alarm her, but there's a problem.
Yep, he's connecting those dots.
Ugh. Awful. We go back to the ER where Neela is reporting that she found out that Elgin, who we met last episode, has primary hypertension. CT came back clean, though. But his echo revealed a problem, and Pratt still seems unconcerned. I'm sure this won't be a problem later on.
Because Elgin's so young, and yo, kids that young can't get primary hypertension. I'm sure you're wrong.
Congenital heart failure.
Congestive heart failure.
My bad.
And then our old guy from a little bit ago, Mr. Ferguson, there's no apparent medical cause for his behavior. Abby is pretty sure that his dementia is just worsening, and she isn't sure if she passed her boards. Also important as we go along here. And then we get the most random but kind of weirdly welcome, I felt, appearance of Rachel. One Rachel Green making a surprise appearance, returning from the Shadow Realm. First time we have seen her since On the Beach. Like, she is not in season 9 at all, and we have not seen her. We've not heard mention of her, really, since On the Beach. So it's very odd to see her just pop back in here. And is this where she gets recognized by Jerry at the desk here?
Yeah.
Which is a nice little continuity thing here.
After Frank is like, bitch, the fuck do you want?
Right.
Surgeries on three.
Yeah, they're always, and I was happy to see that because they have seemed to be unless it's like a scene of explicit sadness from Lizzie, they have seemed to be very hesitant to invoke the name Mark Green ever.
Mm-hmm.
And so it was nice to see, you know, Jerry pop in and be like, oh, hey, yeah, it's Rachel. That's Dr. You remember Frank? This is Dr. Green's daughter. You know, it's like such a, like, just a nice continuity thing, you know. And that, you know, me being the continuity dork that I am, I'm thinking back to like season one or whatever when Jerry's basically babysitting Rachel at the desk with the anatomy books, you know, and like now she's looking at college. It's just cool. So yeah, we'll get more of Rachel as we go along here. But then we see Carter driving with Kim recklessly to get to the ER. He's clearly very concerned that the baby is in distress. But Kim still seems confident that nothing is wrong. So, and then we go back and see check in with Neela, who's trying to reach Elgin, but is not having much luck. And then we see Sam get some ice cream delivered to the ER. And I hate it. Because, like, it's like, I think it's the next scene we see with them where we find out the particulars of the origin story of Sam and Steve.
Yeah.
And it's not just a toxic relationship, friends. It's downright icky. It's gross.
Yeah. Well, anyway, Corday is letting Jen know that Rachel is here. Oh, hey, Jen's name is back from the Shadow Realm.
Jen Green calling from the Shadow Realm.
She's with a guy in tow named BJ. And she's not living at home anymore, and the sexy surgeon guy, can't remember his name, confirms a date for Saturday night. But Rachel says all she wants is just to check out a couple of colleges in Chicago. I believe she said, like, Northwestern and U of I.
Yep, that sounds right.
Yeah, and I think, again, you know, fuzzy timelines and all, I think Rachel is supposed to be about 16 here.
16 or 17 here, yeah. Yeah,
which, you know, makes sense.
That tracks.
It makes sense for, like, that's about the time when you start looking at colleges seriously. But what it doesn't make sense is how she was able to so easily get out from under Jen Green's roof and just apparently go off on her own to Illinois because...
BJ has magical powers.
It usually does. Unless something has changed on that front, we're safe to assume that Jen is still living in St. Louis. And so that means that that Rachel's crossing state lines as a minor, you know, just living with a friend, hand wave. Like, it's kind of a stretch.
Who knows? But then we learn the awful, awful Sam and Steve thing. She met Steve while she was working at an ice cream shop. I think she said in the mall. Or was it just that
when she was, like, 15?
When she was 15, and he and his buddies would come by and hang out. And, like, so they started dating, and Sam's parents weren't thrilled about her dating Steve, and then, bam, Alex happened. And while all this story is being discussed, Frank nabs one of the sundaes and suggests one treat won't kill him, to which Neela says, you know, in your case, that adage may not be true. I think it was Neela.
Yeah, it is Neela. Does he, I can't remember, is it, both are bad, but, like, I just can't remember to what degree it is. I know she's 15, but was he 23 or 26? I can't remember.
I think 23. He was,
either way, it was a very illegal relationship.
Right. It was
very predatory.
Bad. So in addition to being a dead-eyed psychopath asshole, he's also a fucking, you know, statutory rapist. Yeah.
But then we go, continuing the tragedy, we go up into the OB with Kem and Carter. The ultrasound, the baby is absolutely not moving. The OB doctor confirms that the boy has died. She doesn't know why he passed, but needs to induce Kem for labor ASAP. Kem's horrified that she has to deliver this baby still, and the induction may take upwards of 24 hours or more.
This is... like, from the beginning of the episode to here, like, this is, like, I'm going to say between 15 and 20 minutes into the episode. Like, this is barely halfway. And, like, there's no, like, again, there's no build to this. I mean, there is a build, but there's no, like, there's no gotcha moment. Like, there's no, like, oh, maybe we'll give a sliver of hope. Nope. It's just like, this sucks, and it's going to continue to suck. And whew, it is hard to watch. Trauma porn, I believe, as Aaron so eloquently put it in his listener response. It's a lot. It is a lot to deal with. Our doctor here, who is an excellent addition to this episode. Like, she really does add quite a bit, I think, to, you know, what is obviously a very sad proceeding. But she's played by actress Blair Brown, who appeared in stuff like The Days and Nights of Molly Dodd, Space Cowboys, and a recurring role on Orange is the New Black, which I think is the thing that I probably recognize her from modern stuff the best from.
But then we go back. Neil wants to go find Elgin to make sure he's okay, but he lives in a very rough part of town, so Pratt will escort her after their shifts are done. I want to note she mentions MapQuest here, and it absolutely made my day. She's like, oh, I looked it up on MapQuest. It's maybe 15 minutes. And Pratt's like, no, you're not going there alone. Like, no, I'm coming with you.
What a time to be alive, MapQuest.
Yeah, and then Carrie's complaining about the naked dementia guy. She does a great alliteration here and threatens, like, something about, like, his restraints or whatever, and it's a very good comedic read, but the wording is so precise and so well delivered by Laura Innes that the notes will not do it justice. But I absolutely got a chuckle about her complaints here. And then Luca's car alarm apparently will not stop, so he needs to go and check it out. This will be fine.
Absolutely. Morris randomly asks Neela out and gets a maybe in response, which is surprising. So yeah, sure, maybe, whatever, yeah. I guess. Maybe.
That is a loud no in red letters.
Yeah. But Kem is very stoic as she gets set up in OB for the induction.
The visceral stoicness, aka catatonia, is what that is. Like, she is, she is, for lack of a better word, she is a husk of a human being at that point. Yep. She has got the 1,000-yard stare. Like, she is so, like, just...
Makemba is not here right now. Please leave a message after the fuck this.
Like, just, yeah.
And turns out Steve was making Kovach's car alarm go off and asked Kovach to back off because he wants to get back with Sam. And he says, oh, they belong together. The three of them. And this entire time, the look on Kovach's face just looks like he wants to beat the shit out of this man so hard.
See, why can't he do it to somebody who actually deserves it?
Because it's still assault, and, you know...
Yeah. But that hasn't stopped him before!
I know, but he did a murder. It's okay. Just some light murder. It's fine.
It makes me really mad that we've already done the Kovach accidentally killed a guy thing. Because I feel like that's a well you can't go to twice, you know? And so I feel like I would have enjoyed more... the inevitable conclusion to this, which is that, you know, Kovach stumbles into a situation, maybe Steve is assaulting Sam or whatever, and like literally just beats him to death, and then like we have to have this like unspoken thing where it's like, you know, I'm not even saying I want Sam and Luca to end up together as a result of it. I want it to just be this thing that happened that they just don't talk about but kind of silently acknowledge as like Luca did her a solid. Like, I don't know, it just, because it does sort of feel like the Luca, if you're gonna do the Luca accidentally killed a guy thing, it does feel like it was a little bit wasted on this rando guy from a couple seasons ago, you know? Like, I want it to mean something.
Yeah,
and it would be,
I mean, he could just be moving his car just so it doesn't get disturbed as much, and then I didn't see him
moving his car back and forth.
Yeah, I didn't mean to run him over 3 times in a row.
I thought,
like,
it was a garbage bag.
I was just panicking. I didn't know what I was doing.
So I think I would have...
Total accident, bro. Could happen to anyone.
I think I would have appreciated that a little bit more. But yeah, more to come on Kovach and Steve. But for now, we see Neela and Pratt on a bit of a field trip getting over to Elgin's place. They knock on the door, but nobody's there. And just as they're about to leave, they find him struggling down the hallway, clearly not doing well. He stopped taking his heart meds that he was prescribed because he was told, I forget whether it was Pratt that told him this, or it was another, maybe the pharmacist or whatever, that like his symptoms would get better if he would just diet and exercise. So he took that to
He
took that to mean that he could avoid taking the medication, basically.
Yeah, I think Neil is the one who told him, like, hey, take your meds and do this. And he was like, he heard it as, or do this.
So Neela really, Pratt is trying to tell him that if he just starts taking the meds, he'll be fine. But Neela really wants to bring him to county. Right move, Neela. So more to come on that in a bit.
Can we say fuck Pratt in this episode, please?
It's a little bit, you know, he's a developing boy, you know, like he's been a bit up and down this season. I was very on the fence. Spoilers for the wrap up in a couple of weeks. I was very on the fence about like maybe a Pratt for least favorite character nomination, but I don't feel like that's 100% fair because he has had his moments. But the low moments are still pretty darn low for Pratt.
I just was on record. I just need to say right now, I'm salty. Lizzie already beat me to the wrap up, so I officially am third choice again, guys.
Again.
Daniel just told us it was up, and as we were getting ready to record this, Lizzie snuck in her answers. I will never have a chance to be first pick.
Justice for Lauren. But we go over and check in on Abby, who's not sure that if she's going to be going to her own graduation. And Carrie pulls her aside to talk to Abby about the matches because she failed her boards, which is a little bit, you know, I was getting a vibe from some of the listener responses from people in the medical field that this is a bit of a like kosher gray area for Carrie. Like this is maybe not, she should not be having this conversation with Abby, which Abby kind of comes right out and says here as well. She's basically encouraging Abby to unmatch from county, which Abby rejects outright and threatens to report Carrie. So it's one of the weirder moments in this episode, like, because it feels like it comes out of nowhere and it feels like it's unnecessarily, not mean spirited, but just unnecessarily, curt from Carrie here to like suddenly suggest that, that Abby should look elsewhere.
Yeah, don't leave us in a lurch. Pick somewhere else.
Especially considering, you know, the recent nature of the relationship between Carrie and Abby. Like, Abby's been there for Carrie a couple of times over the last, you know, couple of big crises. So you wouldn't think that she would just hang Abby out to dry like that. But then we go over and check on Luca and Sam. Luca's bailing on their date and is basically just, without saying it, saying that he's breaking up with her, you know. Which I don't 100%, from Luca's perspective, at least given the information that he has available to him, you know, other than the weird, you know, interaction at his car. I could certainly understand him wanting to be like, hey, you should get out of this situation and like, warning her basically, but I could also see him not wanting to touch it with a 10-foot pole either. Like, I could see him being like, this, that seems like it sucks and you should probably figure a way out of it, but also I don't want to be involved, and then do like finger guns as he backs out of the door like SpongeBob.
That does seem like a very Luca
right?
thing
like
to
he's
do.
Got enough going on, like he does not need this bullshit too.
The overemphasized American
right.
thing of that.
Puts those like 2000s Keanu Reeves sunglasses on and just like backs out of the room doing finger guns. And then we go back and check in on Carter and Kim. It's now night and Carter is noting with the time difference that it's probably going to be morning in Kinshasa. And so he offers to call Kim's family for her to let them know. And Kim reacts very negatively to that suggestion, does not want anyone to know that this has happened.
I thought she was French. I thought her parents were in France because I thought she was French.
I believe that is what we were told originally, but what Carter says is that it's morning in Kinshasa.
Oh, okay. My bad.
And remember, she said that her dad, that he had done the work there and she had carried it on in Kinshasa.
Gotcha.
And
yeah.
That's why she had lived in the Congo.
Yeah, I just
gotcha.
So she is French, but I think they moved to the Congo.
Yeah. But yeah, she does not want anyone to know what has happened, which understandable from her standpoint. There's a lot of, you know, complex feelings, guilt, grief, sadness, immeasurable sadness. Like, I it's a very fresh wound, too. Like, totally understand where she's coming from. And I totally understand where Carter's coming from, too. I understand his very helpless feeling of, like, I want to do anything I can to help make this situation that isn't fixable even, like, 1% better. So it's like, if I...
As a chronic fixer, I absolutely get that.
Yeah, totally, totally. Like, there's been plenty to gripe about with Carter over the years with various things, but, like, this isn't one of them.
This ain't it, Chief.
We go back over to Rachel and Lizzie. Rachel's poking fun at Lizzie for dating two guys at once. Because it's a silly situation. Ha ha ha. Nothing is funny in this episode. But we find out Rachel is really in Chicago for a Plan B prescription, because if she tried to do it in St. Louis, it would probably get back to Jen somehow. And then go back up to the sadness area. Kem's epidural is apparently working too well. Like, she just straight up can't feel anything. Like, even, like, people poking at her or anything like that. So Carter steps out for some coffee while they get all that stuff adjusted and get Kem resettled. And he has a conversation with another dad, Nobi, who's having his third kid.
And the way Carter has to just, like, play along with this conversation is so fucking heartbreaking. It just breaks your heart. And the dad at the vending machine here, who we don't really get a name for, he's played by actor Gernard Birks, which is a great name. He has appeared in stuff like Starsky and Hutch, the movie, not the TV show, the movie, Leon the Professional, and The Hangover.
Oh, and then it keeps getting worse. Sam gets home, and we learn Steve sent the ice cream and is currently a little drunk. He states his intentions, as Lizzie puts it, to get the band back together.
What else can you say?
He starts to get very close and handsy with Sam, really putting the moves on her. And she uncomfortably rejects him again and says, please let me pass. And she seems really scared of him when she finally gets past him and shuts the door and cries in the other room. So just, like, she is not good in this situation at all. Speaking of not good, we're back to labor and baby Carter is crowning. And we learn apparently he managed to twist his umbilical cord and cut off his own circulation. The doctor says it was just bad luck, essentially a freak accident, and Carter's dad shows up and Carter cries in his arms, all very well acted.
Like, I and feel then, like that doesn't fully paint the picture. Like, it's,
no.
It's some of the best work Noah Wiley has ever done. Like,
mm-hmm. Yeah, but like I said, a lot of this stuff is
it's very visual. It's something you have to see to appreciate, but just I've gone on record before, talking kind of about the stabbing, that, like, I think Noah Wiley can be sometimes a bit of a ham and, like, go too far. This is not one of those times. Like, this is a pitch perfect, like, portrayal of just the way he just, like, dissolves the second he sees his dad and walks up to him, and the way that, like, the actor playing his dad has to, like, hold him up, you know, like, has to bear his weight, which is a really nice companion to where we left them in the last episode, where, like, he's basically just talking shit about Carter's career choices and about his, you know, relationship with Kem and everything. Like, they left a very sour taste in your mouth for that character the last time you saw him. And here, maybe for the first time ever in the show, we're seeing him just be a good dad, like, just be there for his son in a way that he wasn't for the stabbing incident. You know, like, they kind of left him on an island by himself for that, and, like, here he's actually there supporting him, and it's again, just like everything else in this episode, it's really great, but it's brutal to watch.
Very good point. And this next point, our listeners do a great job going into this part in depth, so I'm just gonna leave it at, the ER staff finds out about Carter and Kem. There are some words about how this is handled in our listener responses, so I'm gonna let the listeners do that, because
it does leave a lot to be desired.
Yep.
And I got this next audio clip because I'm pretty sure Daniel would have reached through Zoom and actually, like, punched me in the face if I hadn't gotten it. Nothing really of consequential.
Just the best line of the entire series. 331 episodes can be boiled down into this next clip.
All right. Neela is giving her family a tour of the ER.
And this is the admit area where we keep a track of all the patients we have in the ER. That's Jerry. He makes this whole place work, and he's very big. And that's Frank. He works with Jerry. He just had a massive heart attack and shouldn't be eating that donut. And this is the ER staff. Staff, this is my family.
Nice to meet you.
Hello. Okay, well, lovely to see you all. Down this way are the trauma and exam rooms where we save the lives of unfortunate souls who end up here. On a busy shift, we'll see over 120 patients, sometimes as many as 200. Back there is a suture room where we attend to minor skin wounds. That's a naked patient. Let's step through this way.
Old man just walks by. But also, Daniel, why is this your line of the series?
What's not to love?
It's perfect.
That's Jerry. He makes this place run, and he's very big. What? Tell me how that's not just the motto for Team Jerry. Like, that is... we should have that on a shirt.
But then her delivery of Frank right after is what
it
really
is, and it's, and I had to, like, because I have no joke, listeners. I have had that line saved on my phone as a video clip. I'm gonna find it in my camera roll here so that I can tell you how long I have had it on my phone, because I have had it for literal years at this point. I don't remember when I clipped it. Maybe it was when Jake and I did the flash forward and I was alerted to it. Okay. I have had the clip of just that line of that's Jerry, he makes this place run and he's very big. I have had that on my phone since August 21st of 2021. So I have had that on my phone for 2.5 years. Just as like a week's not going great, you need a little pick me up, you need a little 4 second jolt of happy brain chemicals. That's what I go to, because I love that line. It's read perfectly by Parminder Nagra. She fucking I think that's the funny, that scene, that whole scene of hers there is the funniest she's ever been on the show. Like, without hesitation. I don't think she's ever had a funnier moment on the show than that whole clip. And it just makes me so fucking happy. And you're right, Lauren, having the larger context of the larger clip, it is an excellent follow-up line, the Frank line, that just makes it just another level. And it's so perfectly, like, it's so tonally appropriate and, like, mixed in with this episode. Like, sometimes, as we learned in the early seasons, they would do these episodes with these harsh tonal shifts where it would be like
whiplash.
Right, it would be just like horrific, soul crushing shit happening in one room, and in the other room there's a guy plucking a chicken, like, or a turkey or whatever. Like, there's just like these diametrically opposed things, and it took them a while to figure out like where the line was and what they could get away with. And this is, I think, a perfect kind of just like slip it in as like a little like, hey, you know, it's not always it's not always dark. Like, I know there's this horrible thing happening somewhere else in the hospital, and Neela's a perfect vehicle for it, because of the main cast that is, you know, in this episode and active, she's the one that probably has the most tenuous connection to Carter. Like, she knows Carter, she is familiar with Carter. But they're not really, like, friends. They're not really...
Carter stood up for her a little bit,
but, like, they're not, like, best buddies. Like, they're not... She's not his protege. Like, there's no big emotional tether between Neela and Carter. So if you're going to have anybody be the vehicle for the comic relief in this episode, I think Neela is a perfect choice for it. And I'm so glad we grabbed it. I of course, use this clip as the social media clip for this episode.
Yeah.
Because...
Oh, I would be disappointed
because
if you
I
didn't.
Was certainly not going to fucking do it with any of the stuff happening in that other room. Like, that just seems like a recipe for a spicy comment section, and I don't want it. So, like, this right here, nice soothing balm in the middle of a fucking shit show. Chef kiss. 10 out of 10, John Wells. But now that we've had our little treat, now we have to go back and deal with this. Kem's being bandaged up while a nurse does the required ID markings on baby Carter's paperwork. Oh, it's even worse because we used to call Carter baby Carter. It's even worse. We then go over and see Lizzie asking Dr. Lawson, the hot surgeon, asking him for the Plan B prescription. And he's like, oh, what am I going to get out of this? hot banter. This is the last time you'll ever see Dr. Lawson. So presumably what I choose. So, you know, the short story is he writes this Plan B prescription and fucks off to the Shadow Realm. But what I choose to believe is that the T-1000 in St. Louis finds out who wrote the Plan B prescription for her 16-year-old daughter and then travels through time to kill Dr. Lawson before he ever becomes a medical surgeon. So I choose to believe that's what's happening here. And then we go back and check in on Kim again. She's going to stay for a day in the hospital, and the OB doc urges Carter to get Kim to say goodbye to the baby because up to this point, Kim has been very adamant that she, like, I think once the baby is delivered, like, she outright rejects and is like, I don't want to see him. Like, so it's like, she not only doesn't want to hold him, she doesn't want to see him. And so she's trying to impress, the doctor is trying to impress upon Carter the importance of getting her to say her formal goodbyes, and that this is, you know, she's been doing this for so many years, and that all the mothers who choose not to do this ultimately end up regretting it. So, hits just keep on coming.
But Rachel likes that Lizzie's dating again and says, oh, Mark would want her to be happy. Well, that's just a kick in the emotional nuts along with that. Right. And they both say it. They're both just kind of briefly bond over
right.
just missing
it's
him.
It's so good in that way, though. Like, I'm so glad that they were not afraid to, you know, invoke the name. And I like it as a growth thing, because if you'll remember, like, towards the end of the Mark Green death saga, we didn't leave Lizzie and Rachel in the best place.
Mm-mm.
You know, Lizzie and Rachel were kind of at each other's throats by then, and it was a nice growth thing to see both of them having some space and some separation from the whole situation to have a chance to grow and mature and come to a more peaceful place. You know, I love the way, you know, when Rachel first shows up, like, I love the way that when she asks if they can stay for a couple of days, you know, like, Lizzie's clearly cagey about it, you know, because she's like, I don't know, like, this, you're 16 and you just showed up on my doorstep and you say you're not living with your mother anymore. But she does immediately say, like, you're always welcome. And it's such a nice growth thing from where we left them back in season 8.
Abby and Luca are visiting Carter. Carter thanks them, but politely asks them to leave because there's not really anything they can do. So, but Carter's dad is just going to stay anyway, which I think is very appropriate.
As he should.
Yeah. And then it's graduation time and Abby has not shown up yet. Carter tries to get Kim to hold the baby and she does not respond, continuing on that catatonic grind. We see Susan at the I'm on my own.
Lauren's
ride right
Lauren's,
now, trying to
yeah,
get
Lauren's
through this.
Lauren's on her
so.
Own catatonic grind.
I'm trying my hardest right now. I've got the brain zaps, so just work with me. Susan's at the graduation ceremony, and Lester's hat, of course, says "Hi, Mom" on it because he's a huge dork, and we love him.
We'll never see him again.
So, hi, Mom, bye, Mom, bye, Lester.
I think we hear his name in a minute where he gets announced at graduation, but yeah, we are done with Lester. Which is kind of a shame. Like, a character, a background.
I liked him.
Right? Like, a background tertiary character, I feel like I would have enjoyed seeing more than just occasionally.
Yeah.
All right. Elgin is brought to the hospital via ambulance because he's having trouble breathing. Oh, who could have seen this coming? Oh, wow. What a shocking turn of events. His pulse ox is only 70 fucking 8.
That's bad.
For reference, that is not good.
Isn't it anything under 93?
Yeah.
Yeah, I think, because that's what I've heard. When you have COVID, if your pulse ox drops below 93, immediately go to the hospital.
When I had COVID the first time, mine a couple of times the first night or two got into the like 94, 95 range. And Jen was like, we're going to keep a close eye on that. Like, she was like, if that drops much further, then we need to go to the hospital.
But Pratt insists, oh, no, he's fine. Like, he's seeing this kid struggling to gasping for air in front of him being brought in by an ambulance. It's like, oh no, he's fine. He's just needs to exercise a little. That turned into a really bad Pratt impression. I apologize. But oh yeah, Chen just says, oh yeah, he only has a little congestive heart failure. going on right now.
As a treat.
Yeah. And Pratt definitely has an, oh, fuck, I fucked up.
He has his face right now,
as he should. God damn it, Pratt.
That face could be, like, his face for this whole season. Like, he's had that face quite a few times. He broke a guy's neck. He kind of did a little bit of a light sexual assault on a woman. And now he has ignored a classic case of congestive heart failure. Like, he's really batting 1,000 in the dumb fuck batting average this season. Like, he's really fucked up quite a bit. But we go back over to graduation, which is 100% not in Chicago. I don't remember if I grabbed the part.
Aaron did. I think you put it in.
Yeah, it was in part of his, you know, Aaron length listener response, that it's clearly USC is the campus there. Very much not Chicago, as you might imagine when they're filming in LA. But
yeah, we did not get it, so good catch.
And then we go back and see Carter and his dad chatting. Carter is holding a small baggie with presumably a lock of the baby's hair and just kind of pondering over it. And it's, you know, Carter's like not sure if Kim will even want to be with him anymore, much less want to have a baby with him, try to have a baby with him again. And again, this is such an excellent note to leave this character on, because we get this moment of genuine bonding between Carter and his dad, where he divulges some of the, you know, for lack of a better word, gory details of Carter's brother's death and how that affected him and how it affected his relationship with Carter's mother and like all these things. That's just like, they really saved the best for last with Carter's dad, a character who's very much written to be kind of a joke and, you know, kind of a somebody to be easily dismissed. And they really land the plane very well, very, very well with him. So, but that is the last we will be seeing of Carter's dad. We won't be seeing him anymore. We randomly see Steve at the graduation ceremony with Sam and Alex, which is weird. Like, having done graduation stuff for other things in the past, graduation tickets are not easy to come by. Like, it's not the kind of thing that you can just show up on a whim. You know, you kind of have to have that stuff planned out.
And like, well, who would they even be there for? Sam's not particularly close to any of
that's
them.
That's true, yeah. They're not particularly close to Abby or Neela, so it doesn't really make sense for them to be there.
I was going
to
say, maybe Abby, because Abby used to be a nurse.
Maybe. So. But Sam more or less takes Abby's place when Abby decides to go back to medical school, so it's kind of a, you know, it's flimsy. I mean, I get why they're there, because they're going to set up an awkward, you know, stare across the room from Steve to Luca. Like, I get why they need to be there, but... yeah. And then we see Abby off to the side or off in her car after the contractually obligated Susan Lewis appearance, by the way, which I forgot to mention, like, that we see Susan at graduation for like 10 seconds.
Sorry.
I mentioned that she was there, but didn't go into it.
She's there for like 10 seconds. But she's on the phone, sitting in her car, calling Maggie to let her know that she graduated, and her diploma is just a big piece of paper that says graduation pending, please see the registrar for further information, which is another thing that was pointed out in the goof section, was that just because she maybe didn't pass her boards would not have prevented her from graduating. Like, the it's two separate things. Like, boards are for licensure, whereas graduation is just graduation. Like, that's just, you're just getting your degree. Like, if she had fulfilled all of her credit obligations, like, she, and she's paid up, which they said she was because of what Carter did, she'd get her diploma. Like, she graduated. She just may not be able to practice medicine yet because she doesn't have her board certification. But yeah, it's very nice, you know, nice little, again, continuity tip thing to, that she calls and lets Maggie know that she graduated, even if we don't actually get to see Sally Field in this episode. And then we end the episode on the downest of down notes, where Carter pleads with Kim to say goodbye to the baby. And again, both of these two are just like firing on all cylinders here, like giving you everything they got. And the episode ends on a very, very somber, very sad note. Again,
with the music.
Martin really landed on thick there at the end. This is the greenest of green vegetables of episodes. Like, this is, it's great, and it's probably, it adds a lot of drama and a lot of, you know, character development and depth and all that. It's just not particularly enjoyable to revisit ever, you know.
I'm going to go on record and say that this is truly a bad episode.
Well, I don't agree.
Not, I would say there's good acting in it, but I think this is one of the most unnecessary plot twists in the entire series and one of the most forced drama things that they've ever done. And I hate it.
Okay.
And I hate this episode because of it. Like, I usually skip this on when I do a rewatch.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm just like, I don't need to see this.
That's like, that I think is not an unpopular opinion. Like, I think a lot of people skip this episode. But I mean, I put it not to make a one-to-one comparison. It's just fresh in my mind because I was listening to 30-2010 and they were just talking about the 30th anniversary of it. Don't come for me. But like, it's kind of like Schindler's List. Is Schindler's List a great movie? Unquestionably. Do I want to watch it ever? No. Like, you know, but like, it's two things can be true. You know, it can be extremely well made and it can be extremely well executed and all that, but it can also be just unpleasant to watch and not something that you want to like enjoy, especially as escapist entertainment.
It just sours the whole thing for me and makes me just not want to watch. And I hate that there's an episode of TV. There's an episode of this show, of my favorite show of all time, that I just genuinely do not ever want to watch again.
Yeah.
Well, you don't ever have to now that this is done. Yeah.
And for that, in my mind, it just sits as a bad stain on the series. I hate this storyline so much. Like, if you wanted to do this, could have had it be like a car accident or like some other thing, or have there be like a
problem incident.
Have there be like a problem with the kid and they kind of shuffle around for a few episodes with it.
See, and I disagree.
Like having it as a background and then featuring it in this episode.
I feel like
I hate the suddenness of it and I hate the forced drama.
And I get that. I mean, I get the impulse as a viewer to want that, you know, like to make it make more sense or to feel justified in some way, but like,
well,
but it is so like, again, it's an unflinching portrayal of how this stuff goes. I'm not saying I personally have experience with this because I don't, but I have people in my family who have personal experience with this. And like, this is how it works. This is how it happens. And it is just as like jarring and just as like you're scrambling, searching for any sort of answer or meaning or like, how did this, you know, just all of that.
I'm not saying, sorry, Lauren.
I was going to say, I do think part of it too, though, at least for me, why it leaves a sourer taste in my mouth this time through is we had enough of unexplained tragedy at the end of last year. So I think, like, I agree with you, Daniel. It's a vegetable episode. I like it for what it is, but I think that did make it a lot harder to sit through this time was just like, shit happens. And that's exactly what the last 2 months of 2023 were for Lizzie and I.
It just seems like the writers have been leaning too much on the, I guess someone's dead
now. And I think type thing.
Like in the same season that you had a literal helicopter fall on a man.
I think, again, Aaron alludes to in his response, they've been in their trauma porn era. And like, I just think that of everything we've been served in that vein, this is the most this is the most forgivable, because I don't think this one is in search of a ratings grab. Like,
I think it's lazy writing.
I disagree. I think the helicopter, you could make the argument that was a ratings grab. I think Luca's fake out, you could certainly make the argument that that was a ratings grab. Like, there's been a lot of stuff this season that I would say they tortured people, or they did, like you said, plot twists, gotcha plot twists for the sake of it, just to say they did it to try to like bring more eyeballs back onto the product. And the only thing I will say, you know, against this is that I just wish that we had gotten, and this is more of a general critique of the storyline, I wish we had gotten more of substance of Kim and Carter's relationship before this. We don't get as much of that as I would have liked.
Yeah. I'll say this. I don't know if I think it was lazy writing, considering if you look at this, it was the end game from the beginning. There was no way they were going to ever have Kem have this baby and then go home, and Carter would have not let her go back to the Congo with this child. Right. So, like, and there was no way he was going to go with her. So it was always going to be... Right. They're not going to work through this. I know there's ways to do it.
There's so many better ways to do this.
I'm just saying that I think this was the writing on the wall from when they first had Carter and Kem get together. I think this was the plan the whole time.
They love to do a traumatic birth storyline. Like, they've done it virtually every time. Like, they have done it with Carol. They did it with Reese. They did, you know, even though with Green it was, well, even with Ella, there was some stuff, even though Ella's, it was more after she was born.
Carrie had her miscarriage. Carrie had the
miscarriage. Like, they love to do.
No pregnant main characters.
They love to do a traumatic ever. Birth thing. And other than Carrie's miscarriage, which they never really get far enough, that doesn't get far enough down the road to really be a thing, TM. Like, there's always, somebody pointed this out in one of the comments that I saw. There's always a, like, we saved it. You know, like, it's like, yes, it's traumatic. Yes, it's dramatic. But it always ends up okay. And you had to think that at some point, in 15 years, at some point, they were going to do a storyline with a character involving a birth that was just going to straight up end badly. And what I submit is that that was never going to be a female character that they were going to do that with. They were never going to take one of the principal female characters on this fucking show, put them through the most traumatic thing a woman can go through, and just be like, hey, now they got to deal with it for the rest of the time they're on the show. Enjoy. They were never going to do that.
Lord knows they beat up Carrie.
Lord knows they did. But like, I'm not saying they're immune to putting female characters through trauma. They aren't. But like, when it comes to a traumatic birth or a stillbirth situation or what we're seeing in this episode, they were never going to have fucking Chen do that. They were never going to have Susan do that. They were never going to have any of these principal female characters go through that. So if you're going to have somebody do it, it was probably going to be a male character, and Carter's the only male character who doesn't end up with a female principal cast member. So, like, it was always going to be Carter. It was always going to be Carter. It was, like Lauren said, it was fucking destined from the minute they put those two on screen together. This was always how this story was going to end. And I, again, it's not fun to watch. It's traumatic. It's awful. But I think any other way of doing it, barring just taking what I think would have been the lazier way out, which is to just say, oh, everything was perfect forever, and there were never any problems. That would have been lazy writing. Any other way of doing it, plane crash, car crash, surprise, typhoid, like anything else.
Sorry.
Like anything else would have felt cheap and sensationalistic. Whereas this is much more in that Love's Labor Lost vein, where they are going to pry your eyeballs open, Clockwork Orange style, and go, look at this. It fucking sucks, but you're going to look at it because this is something that people go through and it's fucking horrible and we're not going to pull any punches with it. Is it fun? No. But I will defend the quality of the writing. That this is absolutely a hill I will die on.
But Lizzie, I appreciate your strong stance.
I appreciate the perspective for sure.
Yeah, I was like, it's not often that we're this polarized on an episode in a very long time. So.
And I know both Danielle and I are not alone in our opinions.
For sure, yeah. There's a lot of strong opinions on not just the episode, but the storyline. Lord knows the character of Kem, who... You know, this is not the end of the road for Kem either. We will be seeing more of Kem and Carter and the fallout of all of this. And she gets plenty of shit for it, which she doesn't deserve. But it is just, and just the only thing I can say is just thank God there's one more episode. Can you imagine if they ended the season on this?
Oh, no, they wouldn't do that.
That would just be the ultimate fucking downer way to end a season. Yeah.
They can't, because I need a couple more weeks to recover before we do a wrap-up.
Fair enough. Well, what do the listeners have to say about it, Lauren?
All right, let's see how many of these I can do. I'll be tapping to Daniel soon. But first off, we have Heather R. says, heartbreaking for Carter and Kem, obviously, although I do enjoy the scenes with guest star Michael Gross and Carter. The sobbing hug in the hallway is just, wow, painful. I also like the choice to have Luca and Abby visit Carter, showing how good they can all be as friends and support each other. The graduation. I never really understood why Sam was there with Steve and Alex, except it was an obvious plot point to show, hey, look at the tension with Luca there too, as Steve tries to keep his family together. Nice moment to see Neela and Abby cross the stage, though, even if Abby almost missed it. I guess Michael Gross was big enough for one episode, hence the phone call with Maggie instead of having Sally Field show up for the ceremony. Also, is the only way Elizabeth can get some screen time or storyline is to bring back Rachel? But I didn't hate this either, because it was nice to see the two of them get along and share a moment of talking about Mark. Next, we have at Freelancer Jorn. One of the most memorable and powerful episodes of ER, I loved how both Abby and Luca showed up on the maternity ward to support Carter. It was a moment that showed that even with the tension over the years between Luca and Carter over Abby, they really could show up and support one another when times called for it. I also loved how, when Carter told his father he could leave, his father responded that he would stay. I felt Carter's father staying was his way of making up for not being there when Carter was stabbed. And Daniel, I'm going to defer to you for this last three chunks.
Jen T says, okay, first things first. Carrie telling Abby she needs to change her matches is horrible. Seriously, Carrie knows better. Steve confronting Luca is so good. Hi, Cole, you're a much better Steve than the hillbilly. Okay, now to the meat. Noah and Tandaway shined in this episode. They make me sob every damn time. Add in Michael Gross and just, damn it. It's heartbreaking and I bawl my eyes out every time. Luca and Susan at Abby's graduation is beautiful, but I'm forever confused as to why Sam is there with Steve and Alex. That's not how med school graduations work. Grace B says, I don't want to kill Lauren, and what I really want to say, as co-captain of the Makemba Lakasu defense squad, would veer quickly into an attack against the people who are wrong, and we don't have time for that. So just one thing that has absolutely infuriated me for the last 4 years I've been a fan of this show. What the fuck is that scene between Lizzie, Jingmei, and Carrie after the ad break? Jingmei's I can't even imagine is ridiculously wooden, and not necessarily Ming-Na Wen's delivery, the writing. It's like they're not friends at all. It's unbelievably impersonal, especially given the scene her and Carter had just a few episodes ago. Seriously, the missed opportunity of drawing the heartbreaking parallel of Carter being Jingmei's birth coach slash partner only 3 years ago, after which she gave up her son for adoption, and now his son has been stillborn. Dude, you get to put words in Ming-Na Wen's mouth. Give her breathing space to remind the audience of the emotional layers here, for fuck's sake. That's actually in the response. That's not editor's note here. But what really grinds my and excellent point too, by the way. Chen is a glaring omission in the like Carter consolation parade. You know,
squad.
Yeah. Like she, given the rich kind of like and continuously recognized history between those two characters, I would really have expected her to have more to do with what happens here. But what really grinds my gears is Carrie's those poor people line. You mean your friend? The guy you've known since he was your med student? The guy who used to be your freaking roommate? The guy who would be dead about twice over if it wasn't for you? That's how you're going to talk about him and his fiance? And Lizzie, honestly, you and Carter don't have much of a personal relationship. Why is Lizzie talking about going up there to sit with them? Why aren't Jingmei and Carrie already up on the maternity floor? But you do know what you could do. Offer to call Peter Benton. That would honestly be a much more meaningful piece of dialogue for you to contribute to this scene. I choose to believe, or I venture to say, that probably was bandied about. Like, I would think that was probably a thing that was considered and either logistically wasn't going to work, or maybe Eric LaSalle said no, or maybe for whatever reason they just decided against it. But I would not be at all surprised if that was something that was on the table at one point, because it just makes too much sense not to happen. And last but certainly not least, at the full-time dads, ER has firmly been in its trauma porn phase for going on 2 years, and Midnight is arguably the most heartbreaking of the series during that stretch outside of Mark's death. But unlike many of the storylines during this darker period, I give the writers credit for striking the right balance of joy and pain here. From Frank's return to the desk and the reminders that, yes, he's just had a heart attack, so stop with the sweets, to Rachel's penultimate episode and the playful tap dance she and Lizzie do throughout the episode, the introduction to Neela's big family and Abby's sweet call with Maggie, these moments help to counterbalance the personal tragedy of Carter and Kim. There's also the increasingly darkening storyline of Sam and Steve 1.0, who is finding his stride as a truly menacing character. Sam gives us some of her strongest moments when she breaks down after thwarting Steve's advances. She's truly terrified, but does it without being over the top. And then there's Greg and his failure of Elgin. It's so frustrating to watch him dismiss Neela's valid concerns about Elgin's health and then act shocked when those concerns become fully realized. Between the tube incident and this, the writers are working overdrive to remind us that Greg isn't the fully formed doctor we come to love in later seasons. I haven't had a good Aaron listener response to sink my teeth into for a while here, so I'm very glad he was able to get this one in under the tag.
Thank y'all for showing up en masse for this one. I was looking at it and I was like, I'm really excited to what everybody has to say, but God, I'm not going to read all of it. So I thank you so much for everybody showing up, because we knew this was a big episode.
This was far and away, I think, probably the most responses we've gotten for an episode in a while. There were quite a few more I could have grabbed. So shout out to everybody for coming out strong for this one.
Good job. But that's going to wrap up our episode for today. Thank you all very much for listening, as always. The show is brought to you in part by our patrons over at patreon.com/sanitonepodcast, where for the low price of only $5 a month, you can get an assortment of stickers, including one featuring our favorite desk clerk, Jerry.
He makes this place run, and he's very big.
There you go. And over 75 hours of bonus audio and video content, including the full season recap episodes. Hard to believe we're almost to the end of season 10. A freeform multi-bonus show called The Lounge. Movie reviews, where we talk about a movie featuring an ER cast member. And character retrospectives, where we reflect on departed main cast members. Look for a bunch more of those next season. We would also appreciate it if you would follow us on our social media accounts. We are on Facebook at facebook.com/sandthetonepodcast. And we are at sandthetonepodcast on Instagram. Also, be sure to check out the official Sand and Tone community on Facebook. Our theme music is provided to us by Andrew M. Edwards and Daniel. Where can folks find you at?
You can find me on Instagram at dan.u, that is Y-O-U.E-L. They can also find me on my other podcast, The Popular Court, with my co-host Jake Terrell, where we do a different pop culture topic each episode and put it through a little mock trial.
And Lauren, where can folks find you at?
They can find me continuing on my road to recovery, excited that I could actually finish a book this weekend.
Awesome. Love to see it. You can find me on Twitter. I am at Random Gamer. That's JAM3R. Thanks again to everyone very much for listening. Please join us again next time and have a great week.